Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to keep America safe from attacks by non-state actors? The events of 9/11 revealed a dangerous lack of cohesive counterterrorism strategy and preparation in the U.S., made worse by the silos between different federal agencies with national security responsibilities. But as my guest today will tell us, since that time, the U.S. has refined a wide-reaching and largely effective plan to identify, locate, and eliminate enemies not tied to foreign governments. Aki Peretz is National Security Advisor to the think tank Third Way and a veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. His new book, co-authored by Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Eric Rosenbach, is called Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Aki, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about the state of U.S. counterterrorism strategy before 9/11.
It was a really strange and siloed situation. So one of the things that my colleague and co-author Eric Rosenbach and I talked a lot about when we would talk about counterterrorism issues and national security issues was that on 9/11 we really had no strategy to confront non-state actors such as Al-Qaeda. And we had a lot of resources. And what our book talks about is we had tons of resources. The CIA had many resources, FBI has many resources, and the military had resources. But we actually had no strategy. So when 9/11 happened, we had a lot of tactical successes, but we made a lot of strategic mistakes. And it really took several years for our strategy to really catch up with our tactics and also our technology. And that's basically why we wrote the book.
Yeah, initially our instinct was to go to war in a conventional sense after the attacks because that was what we were familiar with from World War II.
Yeah, that's right. There's this old... The old saw that you always fight the last war.
And obviously in this case, that did not immediately eliminate the threats that were posed to this country.
That is correct. We went in and very successfully in its own way into Afghanistan, but we really didn't finish the job. And then, as we all sort of know from the last several years, we sort of started getting ready for the next war in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. You characterized the war in Iraq as a rather pointless distraction.
That's correct. By 2002, we were actually pulling out resources from South Asia to really get ready for the fight in Iraq. And in my view, and in the counterterrorism, from the counterterrorism perspective, that really took our eye off the ball from the person and the groups that actually hit us on 9/11, which was Al-Qaeda.
So we took these initially somewhat reflexive steps, recognized, though, that we needed to get our act together. How did it happen that a strategy first articulated by Ulysses S. Grant and refined during the Korean War emerged as the clear winner in an effort to get a handle on the postmodern threat of terrorism?
Well, what we tried to do is we called it find, fix, finish, and it's really more of a shorthand about how the U.S. locates and tracks and really gets rid of its enemies. Very quickly, you have to really find and you have to identify the adversary, and you have to find out who is he, what does he stand for, what makes him tick. And then when you have to fix him, you have to get him in a box, so to speak. You have to corner him in a specific area, whether it's a city, whether it's a neighborhood, and then you have to finish him, and you have to eliminate the threat he poses either through death or incarceration. And in the past, especially in the post-World War II era, we used find, fix, finish against our main enemy, which was the Soviet Union. And we knew how to find them. We knew that they had cities, and we knew how they had embassies and army units and so forth. But we could never really finish them because that would have created mutually assured destruction. But after 9/11, we really had to turn find, fix, finish on its head. The finding part became the hardest part, and the finishing part actually was the easiest part because we were hunting individuals. We had to change our entire national security apparatus both overtly and covertly, to meet that new threat.
Yeah, because these responsibilities are now divided up. You have the finishing part that's carried out in many cases, at least if you're choosing a lethal end for these individuals. That's being carried out by the military. The other side, the other two components are intelligence functions.
That's correct, and therein lies the problem is that before 9/11 and during the Cold War, we had a relationship with the Soviet Union. We would talk to them, and they would come to we would have summits, and we would chat and so forth. But now, how do you talk to actually a non-state actor, or especially a group that really wants to destroy you, such as Al Qaeda? So it becomes much more difficult.
How have the working relationships between civilian and military security personnel evolved over the past decade?
This is something that really, like you said, it has really evolved. So prior to 9/11, there were major silos between the civilian agencies, so let's say the CIA, FBI, and let's say the State Department, and the military. But as we see after 9/11, especially in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, we see how the civilian agencies and the military agencies really fuse together their ability to hunt terrorism. From a counterterrorism perspective, this has become very, very effective, and this is what we're deploying right now all over the world, where the military would, let's say, hunt folks in Afghanistan, and our civilian folks would actually feed them information, and then the military folks would give us information and so forth, and be a very sort of a virtuous cycle of fighting terror.
I want to talk, Aki, a little bit about the formation of those silos, because, you know, today it's easy to sit here and say, how could we have been so stupid and so petty as to create these things? I mean, were there reasons beyond individual ambition and sort of small jealousies that caused these silos to form? And were there things about them that allowed the organizations in question to function better?
Well, a lot of them, that's a very good question, actually. A lot of this is actually historic. Going back to World War II, and this is not in the book, but going back to World War II, the military was actually very much against creating a civilian intelligence agency. So in World War II, we had the OSS. During the Cold War era, you had the military wanting to fight traditional military operations, and you had also the intelligence folks wanting to do what they do. And so you had an issue of mission, you had an issue of personal incentives, bureaucratic incentives, and a lot of sort of turf battles would emerge from this sort of thing. So, for example, the CIA could not operate in the United States according to the charter, according to the law,
mm-hmm.
and the FBI would do everything domestically. However, there's always this potential for, let's say, somebody overseas to come to the United States and to do, let's say, bad things. And so you would have to have a CIA function give information to the FBI. And obviously there were bureaucratic incentives and disincentives to behave. And there were also personal relationships that had to be cultivated. And after 9/11, there was a real attempt to actually fuse a lot of these people together, to get people in the room just to talk to each other so they understand where they're coming from. But also bureaucratically, you had a lot more interagency relationships that really smoothed out a lot of the bumps in the road.
That fusion also makes more sense when it's a little bit harder to tell exactly, you know, who our enemies are, where they're coming from. You can't necessarily put them in a specific box and say, okay, this is the job of the Army and we'll give this one to the CIA and the FBI can handle that.
Yes, it's very, very difficult, especially when you're dealing with a non-state actor, because you don't really know how to interact with them. Are they an intelligence threat? Are they a military threat? If they're in the United States, are they a domestic threat? So does this break down to, let's say, how the FBI should attack them, or local, state and local police folks should attack them? So it's actually an extremely complicated question.
So talk about why it's such a challenge to find and fix our enemies today. I guess for one thing, it's much easier to spot an army encamped somewhere than it is to find a group of individuals in a densely packed city.
You hit the nail right on the head. I mean, if there are 100,000 Soviet troops marching toward your city, you can't really miss them.
Mm-hmm.
But finding one person out of, let's say, 300 million people here in the United States or a cell is much more difficult. And you really, really need good human intelligence, signals intelligence, good cop work, a vigilant population to really understand who these folks are. So let me give you a for example.
Okay.
In 2009, there was an attempt by Al Qaeda to bomb the subways in New York City, and it was basically one person going to Pakistan and getting trained up on certain how to build explosives. And then he came back to the United States and he recruited two of his friends. So we're talking really about three individuals and maybe their immediate families. How can you actually determine that these guys are bad guys? They hadn't actually done anything. They didn't have a criminal record. So how could authorities actually find and fix them? And it was through a variety of intelligence gathering methods that that these guys were actually caught and stopped before they actually pulled off their attack.
So let's talk about people who are operating entirely overseas so that we can't simply arrest them. How are decisions made about whether to use legal or lethal means to take them out of operation?
It really depends on where they are and what the situation is. So what we talk about in the book is that around 2004, 2005, we went from trying to actually capturing these individuals, or the top individuals, to really using more lethal means, in at least Al-Qaeda. And the reason for that is pretty simple. It's because a lot of these individuals were in Pakistan. And so when they're in Pakistani cities, you can work with the Pakistani military and the Pakistani intelligence services, and you can actually track them to a house and then surround the house and go in and get them. But once they actually move to another part of beyond the writ of the Pakistani government, it becomes increasingly difficult for a government force to actually go in and kick down a door and grab these guys. And so that's why a lot of these, you might see a lot of information about unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs going in and blowing up a house. So it's actually quite difficult.
Well, it's interesting when you say you can work with the Pakistani government because, as has been demonstrated on multiple occasions over the past decade, sometimes you can and sometimes you can't.
That's very true, and that's sort of a larger diplomatic political problem for the United States. Pakistan is extremely important in fighting Al-Qaeda, but they're also funding groups that are attacking Americans, and obviously, from a larger perspective, not just the counterterrorism perspective, but from a larger diplomatic perspective, this relationship really needs mending. But this is a intergenerational issue. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, America can't walk away from a country of 180 million people that possesses over 100 nuclear weapons.
So to what extent has find, fix, finish shaped foreign policy?
It has shaped it to a great degree. Before 9/11, you actually had the ambassador to Israel say something along the lines of criticizing Israel, saying that they really shouldn't target terrorists for terrorists for targeted killings.
Right.
And they said it was against international law and so on and so forth. And then 9/11 happens, and then that gets flipped on its head. They weren't so wrong after all. We American diplomats famously said that we would bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age if they did not help us get Al-Qaeda. And so it's really changed the prism and the optic of how we actually go after terrorists and how we actually behave toward other countries.
My guest is Aki Peretz. He's senior national security advisor to the think tank Third Way and a veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He's also co-author of the new book Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. We're opening the phone lines now. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior National Security Advisor to the think tank Third Way and a veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, Aki Peretz. He is co-author, along with Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Eric Rosenbach, of the new book, Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Aki, I want to go back to the use of lethal means in fighting terrorism for U.S. purposes. You mentioned earlier the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones is what many of us call them. They've gotten really good, but there are pros and cons to deploying this technology, not least of which is the reality of collateral damage.
Absolutely. Using drones does cause collateral damage. But I think what we Americans have to realize is that we are actually in a war and a conflict with Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And war is a gruesome and cruel affair. And so we have, and like any tool, it can be used for, I guess, for good or, I guess, for not so good. But I'll say three things about the use of drones. Number one is they're really effective in hunting down Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden, in one of his pieces, actually said that he's concerned that his quote-unquote brothers are being targeted by U.S. warplanes in Pakistan constantly. So it kept them from staying in a specific building or specific city for any length of time. And number two is that it doesn't really put U.S. servicemen at risk, and not just uniformed personnel, but also CIA personnel. And finally, it brings the conflict to our enemies in a way not really seen in the history of warfare. Normally, you had to send small groups to take out individuals, and now we don't actually have to do that anymore. So it's a real shift in the way we prosecute conflicts.
Of course, there have been occasions where it's taken multiple attempts to actually get the man we wanted.
That's right. And that actually really shows the limitations of the use of intelligence. There are, who knows, 100,000 buildings in the Fatah in Pakistan. Who lives in any one of them, and who visits any one of them? And it really requires good intelligence, on-the-ground intelligence, to determine who's in which structure.
And assuming, Aki, that a drone strike is in fact effective and takes out the target we want, it doesn't leave behind anybody who might be able to provide us with useful information about what's planned for next time.
That's right. When you kill an individual, you can't talk to them, because dead men tell no tales. Mm-hmm. And we lose all that strategic intelligence. However, sort of what the director of the CIA, Leon Panetta, who's now the Secretary of Defense, once said, it's the only game in town. We can either let these guys walk around and talk and plot and plan, or we can try to take them out. And absent them being arrested, which is beyond the capabilities of the Pakistani government, we have to do something. And so the United States made this decision in about six or seven years ago that we should actually actively target these people via drones.
Let's talk about who gets targeted, because a really interesting element of Find, Fix, Finish is the focus not exclusively on the people at the very top of these organizations, but actually the third tier strategists and operatives.
Mm-hmm. And that's, remember that Al-Qaeda is not just one of the basic premises of being a terrorist group is you actually carry out terrorist attacks. And so you actually need competent people, like in any organization, to go out and commit these operations. And if you keep hitting these people and taking them off the battlefield, you degrade the ability, well, the theory is that you degrade the ability of the organization to actually commit these attacks. And so in the early days, the first individual who was the number three guy, in popular parlance, he was killed, and he was the longtime leader of Al-Qaeda's operational wing. And then you had Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM. He was actually arrested, and so was his successor. And then you had all these sort of second-tier guys who became the number three guy. Eventually, you even had Al-Qaeda's accountant becoming their operational commander. I've never run a major organization before, but I don't think you want an accountant running your operations. And so when you take out these individuals, you really degrade the ability of this organization to commit these attacks.
I'm glad you brought up Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because a lot of people, his story is central to the debate over how we should interrogate people once we have them in custody.
Yes. Very, very quickly, he was the quote-unquote mastermind of 9/11. And what's actually quite interesting is that he wasn't even technically part of al-Qaeda on 9/11. He pledged allegiance to bin Laden afterwards because he was concerned that al-Qaeda and bin Laden and his whole crew would actually back off at the last moment. And so when we caught him in 2003, the United States subjected him to various brutal techniques, and the most famous one is waterboarding the fella. And
dozens of times he was waterboarded.
I believe 183 times.
Okay.
Over the course of a month or two, and so that breaks. I can't do the math that quickly, but that comes out to be 8, 9, 10, 12 times a day. And so he talked a lot about a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that he actually was giving us truth. And that's the problem with using brutal interrogation methods, is that it muddies the water. If the whole point is to provide propaganda or to scare your enemies, then using torture works because it's terribly scary. But if the idea is to elicit information, then it's not good, because you can't tell what's truth and what's fiction.
My guest is Aki Peretz, co-author of Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll go to the phones first and speak with Srinivasan in Denton. Hi, Srinivasan.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. My question is, given the history of we as Americans seem to have forgotten that Al-Qaeda today used to be called Mujahideen about 30 years ago. And my question to the speaker today is, what was the role of the United States foreign policy in promoting Islamic fundamentalism worldwide? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
That is an extremely complicated question. I think what the caller is talking about is the fact that the United States supported Afghan fighters in their fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And we did. However, what he probably also, after 89, 1990, when the Soviets actually left Afghanistan went into this miasma of a civil war for many, many years. And one of those individuals, or one of those groups, happened to be bin Laden, and he had a colleague named Abdullah Azzam. And they eventually created al-Qaeda. But it's kind of a myth that the United States actually funded al-Qaeda at the very beginning. There's never been any evidence, and there have been dozens of very, very good books and great investigative journalists who actually have researched this. They've never actually said that the United States has actually supported bin Laden. We have actually supported groups that attack us now in Afghanistan, but this is about 20 years ago. And so this is sort of the problem of... your friend one day becomes your enemy the next. And we're talking about a whole generation of individuals who have come and gone through South Asia in the fight against either the West or the Soviets and so forth.
How did the older iteration of the Find, Fix, Finish doctrine play out in that battle between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan?
Well, we really thought that we could bleed the Soviets, similar to how communist countries bled us in Vietnam a decade earlier. And we would try to hurt the Soviet Union through their army, through their various capabilities in Afghanistan. We didn't try to create all-out war, because that gets us to sort of the Finnish aspect of things, which we really did not want that to happen. But we really try to find the individuals, or give weapons, give money to the Mujahideen to keep them from keep the Soviets on their toes, so to speak. And we kept giving them weapons, and we give them. We've all seen and read Charlie Wilson's War, a variety of weapons to shoot down their helicopters. And now we're sort of dealing with the blowback 20 years later.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Josh in Plano. Hi, Josh.
Good afternoon. I'll be very brief. Really enjoyed the show today. Your speaker is bringing up all sorts of things which are really interesting. My question is, he mentioned very briefly toward the beginning of the show about the small terrorist cell that ended up being brought down in the United States. I believe it was in the United States. And he mentioned that, you know, that happened by several means, which it's very difficult because unless you know them or their families, how do you find out about this? I was wondering if you might be able to explain maybe what some of those means were, which I'm guessing possibly were phone taps, internet taps, possibly GPS devices on their automobiles, things like that, which leads me to my second question, which is, how much of our freedom does your speaker think the American public should reasonably expect to give up in the name of stopping terrorism, which the war on terror seems to be going the way of the war on drugs, which is very, very frustrating, I think, for anybody who pays attention to that. And very, very lastly, what would the end game be? Should we just expect this war on terror to go on and on and on because terrorists basically sprout up like mushrooms? You get rid of a few of them, a few more pop up. So should we just really dig our heels in and expect this war on terror to go on pretty much for the rest of the foreseeable future?
Josh, thanks for your call. Aki Peretz, lots of big ideas introduced there.
Well, I wrote them down as he was saying this. In terms of what are the means that we can actually track and find and fix these folks? Several means. One, oftentimes, is actually their family members turn them into local authorities. And so we've had half a dozen individuals turned in by their parents or by their neighbors. One of the biggest terror attacks or thwarted terrorist attacks in 2006 was going to be when a number of Al-Qaeda folks are going to blow up planes leaving from London flying here to North America. And it was actually in part stopped by the fact that the guys next door, who were all British Pakistani citizens, said a whole bunch of really angry guys just moved next door and maybe you should take a look at them. So that's actually one thing. Another way is that we actually have a very aggressive FBI that's trying very hard to stop these plots in its infancy. You also have signals intelligence. He was talking about wiretaps. We don't really tap wires anymore, but let's say electronic surveillance is used in a lot of these terror, thwarting these terror attacks. Number two is he mentioned something along the lines of how much freedom should we reasonably expect to give up in this current date. I would suggest that it's actually not a zero-sum game. Only Americans can really undermine American civilization, and we have to see what is the appropriate balance between security and our civil liberties. And without but what people have to really understand is without our civil liberties, the United States ceases to be the country that we are. And so that's to say that we have to be insecure if we have civil liberties, or we can be secure, but we have to give up our civil liberties. I don't think is something that we have to make a choice on. I think we can do both, especially with appropriate legislation. And number three is, what's the end game? I would love to tell you what it is, but I have no idea. This is what I would suggest as an appropriate end game is the way we win is we crush their entire organization's leadership. Every single person on the list has to be taken off the list or incarcerated. And number two, and this is sort of the longer-term issue, and this is the part that you can never really end, but you have to establish a counter-narrative. We have to emphasize that we are not at war with Islam or with terrorism. I mean, your caller talked about the idea of there's a quote-unquote war on terror, and I know that was used about 10 years ago. We actually don't, the United States government actually doesn't use that term anymore. Because it's not a war on terror similar to a war on drugs. We've turned it into a war against Al-Qaeda, which is a much more definable, winnable conflict. And Bin Laden actually said that this is actually a problem for the group, that we've shifted from this war on terror or war against XYZ to this war on Al-Qaeda, which is a specific, discrete group. So it is possible that we could actually win by crushing the organization and by establishing a counter-narrative.
We will not eliminate the threat of terrorism entirely, though, because if it's not Al-Qaeda, theoretically, it's someone else springing up in a decade.
Absolutely. Terrorism, you know, a person much more wise than I said, terrorism is the poor man's military.
And so if you have some kid creating a pipe bomb anywhere in this country, that could be terrorism. And so we're never, ever going to eliminate terrorism, but we can actually stop or lessen the ability of these non-state actors to commit terrorism against civilians.
I want to go back to what you said a couple of minutes ago about appropriate legislation providing sort of checks on the powers of law enforcement and security agencies to infringe upon the rights of American citizens. Should we assume that that responsibility lies entirely with lawmakers, or are substantive debates going on within these, you know, the Pentagon and other places?
Both, actually. You have, and it's easy to... Let me step back. It's very easy to characterize individuals at the CIA or at the FBI or at the White House as being malicious individuals, and they want to grab power and so forth.
That was not my intention, by the way.
No. I know it wasn't your intention, but I think it's easy to fall back on these sort of these tropes. And my experience, and I know that Eric, my co-author's experience, is that you actually have a lot of really hardworking individuals trying to do the best thing for this country, and sometimes that is not the right way, and there are certainly things that policymakers do that one doesn't agree with, it not everybody agrees with, and that's why you actually have Congress stepping in with legislation. If one believes that the federal agencies are overstepping their bounds, whether it's in counterterrorism or legislating the water or so forth, you have a check, and you have Congress. You have to have a well-informed Congress able to make these decisions to say you've gone too far. And this is what, at least in the intelligence business, you know, we saw that in the 1970s when you had the Church and the Pike Commissions that really pulled back the CIA. And you also had this happen after the Iran-Contra scandals of the 1980s.
My guest is Aki Peretz. He's senior national security advisor to the think tank Third Way and a veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. His new book is called Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation, weigh in with a question or a comment at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email along to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Aki Peretz, senior national security advisor to the think tank Third Way and a veteran of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. His new book is written with Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Eric Rosenbach. It's called Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Aki, perhaps your subtitle says it all, Devastated Al-Qaeda, but what is the state of Al-Qaeda today?
Al-Qaeda is on the ropes, and that's a good thing. We have really taken off literally hundreds of people off the battlefield. Either we killed them or they've incarcerated all over the world, and the organization is really reeling. That's the good news. The bad news is that we've seen a fracturing of these groups across the world, and we've seen regional heads really sort of take over and take the lead on their specific issue. And the most lethal one of these guys are the organizations is really the one called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or mm-hmm. AQAP. These are the folks who are in Yemen and to a lesser extent in Saudi Arabia. And these are the individuals who have shown that they wanted to hit the United States. And they tried in 2009 the so-called underwear bomber on Christmas Day. As an aside, I was actually in the air that day when this actually came through, and I was in the airport, and I was watching the news coming in saying that they caught some guy trying to blow up an airplane, and then I got into an airplane, so that was a little scary.
Even for you, with your background in national security.
Well, it's funny because my wife said, "Should we get on this airplane?" And I looked at it. It was coming in through on the television, and it said, "This is a flight coming into the United States." And I said, "Oh, it's fine. We're flying domestically." And number two, these guys are the ones who tried to blow up a cargo plane in 2010, and that was actually stopped due to a tip off by the Saudis, by Saudi intelligence. And so those are the fellas I would suggest we should pay attention to in the future.
Talk about this. What else could we do to ensure ongoing productive collaboration among all the agencies that were siloed before 9/11?
Well, over the last 10 years, we've really seen these folks really work together. And we've created these huge new bureaucracies in Washington and throughout the country that try to integrate all these various other bureaucracies into one mega bureaucracy. And we've actually seen this not be so effective. The best way to get these people to talk to each other is really to get them in the room and get to know each other. The intelligence bureaucracy, the intelligence community, is made up of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of individuals. And when you're dealing with a community that large, it's very difficult for them to actually get to know each other and to get to trust each other. And one way we can do that is really to bring these people into a room and get them to talk about their issues. And so they find out that the other guys aren't there to try to steal their information. They aren't trying to hurt each other. I mean, there is one mission and one fight.
What that sounds like is very time-consuming.
It's extremely time-consuming, and it's also very difficult logistically and so forth. But this fighting terrorism isn't easy.
Aki, what kind of ongoing role, if any, do you see for overseas detention facilities like Guantanamo Bay, like Abu Ghraib?
As we sort of pull out of Afghanistan, as we've pulled out of Iraq, we're going to see, in my opinion, we're going to see a lot less of these overseas detention facilities. And it's unclear whether Guantanamo Bay is actually overseas. But leaving that aside, and this is one of the things that we try to talk about in the book, is that over the course of many years, we've actually tried to prosecute these individuals in American courts, whether it's military courts or civilian courts. They're still American courts. And this brings us back to the whole idea of finishing these guys. In the days and the months after 9/11, we captured a lot of people in Afghanistan and Pakistan and so forth, and we had no idea what to do with these guys. And so we created the Guantanamo Bay detention facility, I believe, in January 2002. So we were attacked in September. We created Guantanamo Bay in January. And we had no idea what to do. And I think we've now realized that that's a really bad idea, to just hold these individuals almost permanently without charge. And it's better for them, it's better for us, to be honest, for us to detain these people, prosecute them, convict them, and then incarcerate them. And then they don't become martyrs to the global jihad. They actually become just downright criminals.
Well, assuming that we're giving everyone a fair trial, it stands to reason that at least some individuals who have been in Guantanamo all this time will walk free.
That's always the case. And what a lot of Americans don't really realize is that we've actually released most of the people from Guantanamo Bay over the last 10 years. A lot of these people are back in their home countries doing whatever it is they're doing. And we're sort of really stuck with the last, I wouldn't say dregs, but these really are a lot of bad people. And we're sort of stuck to figure out what we're supposed to do with these people. And so what we now see is that KSM, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's finally, after 9 years, he's going to some sort of trial, hopefully, and we'll eventually finish these guys, whether it's to prosecute and then convict and then incarcerate them, or to deal with them in however way you want. Let me give you a flip example of what might actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Osama bin Laden's driver, a guy named Salim Hamdan, he was incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay, and he actually became a cause celeb because there was a Supreme Court case called Salim versus Hamdan. Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. And what happened was, we let him go. He you know, we went through the military tribunal system, and then we just let him go. And so now this guy, who was Bin Laden's driver, is now walking free in Yemen doing whatever he's doing, you know, driving a cab or whatever it is. And so we have to make compromises.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi. That was quick. Yes, a simple question. If we had not allowed Saddam Hussein to enter Kuwait and start that entire conflict, would al-Qaeda exist? Would the war on terror ever have developed? Would we have had 9/11? Would any of that have occurred? That's it.
The question is whether had Saddam Hussein not attacked Kuwait, would 9/11 not have occurred? I believe that it's a common misperception, shall we say, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, and he absolutely did not. Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda really didn't like each other. They had almost minimal, if not almost zero contact with each other. And the things that motivated al-Qaeda to do the things that they did were really independent of the way Saddam Hussein and Iraq behaved.
You are a former employee of the U.S. federal government. I mean, to what extent do you think there was deliberate deception created on the part of to convince many Americans that there was a link there?
Deliberate deception is those are fighting words.
Give me the term that you would use.
There was a large PR campaign to engage in a conflict with Iraq based on erroneous information. There were individuals. Look, Saddam Hussein and Iraq, they were just a terrible, terrible guy running a terrible country. But there really had to be political will to go to a full-scale invasion, and that's what we did. That's what we did because there was political will to do so. Another example of this is the Bin Laden raid, which has been in the news, obviously, when it first happened, and we're actually coming up on the one-year anniversary next month on this. You had all the intelligence that suggested that he was in this one specific compound in Pakistan. But we never actually had concrete information on this. And so you really had to have political will by the President of the United States to actually go in and send in special operations forces to finish the job, I suppose. And so it really takes political will to do these things. And that's sort of the larger issue within the book, is that you really need people who are willing to make the choice to take these actions, to fight terrorism or to engage in any kind of foreign policy action.
We have an email here from LeRae who writes, some would argue that drones are expeditious, but such strikes don't address larger, long-term issues, namely Pakistan's 24,000 madrasas supported by Saudi Arabia. That's her figure, not mine. I'm not able to check it at this point. But she asks, the main question is, what other types of strategizing other than extrajudicial killing could be employed?
Every single one of these drone attacks is subject to a matrix of decision-making that occurs before each strike. So it's not like we just have these things floating around and anybody can make the decision. It's really taken very, very seriously. And I've talked to individuals who have actively participated in this. I would not characterize it as extrajudicial. I also want to mention that the Pakistanis know what we're up to. The Pakistani government and a lot of Pakistani press saying, like, well, we're just doing this because we're pushing poor Pakistan around. We have no idea what's happening. But there are drone strikes every month, every 3 weeks or so forth. There's no way that they don't know what's going on. And there's no way that they haven't facilitated this on a massive scale over the last 6 or 7 years. In terms of the idea that there are madrasas, and I'm not sure about the exact number, but you have to remember that Pakistan is a desperately poor country, and they have no system of education. And so what a lot of these madrasas do is they actually give extremely poor Pakistani kids the ability to get some sort of education. And some of them are radical organizations, and some of them are not. It's very difficult to make a blanket statement saying that they're all bad or they're all good when it's a whole shade of gray here.
We were so criticized, particularly in the beginning part of the conflicts of the last decade, for taking a somewhat unilateral approach to our fights around the world. What have we learned about the best ways to collaborate with other countries whose interests may occasionally align with ours and sometimes conflict with our own?
The best way to actually work with countries is really to give them incentives, shall we say. To work with us, so we work with a lot of countries that we agree with. Let's say the Brits, or the French, or the Italians, or the Germans, and we get along swimmingly. But we also work with countries that have more of a checkered career, such as, you know, we've talked about this about Pakistan a lot. We also work with Sudan, which obviously has all kinds of issues, human rights abuses, and otherwise. But we have to understand that we have incentives that, you know, they, as long as our incentives sort of align with what they want, we can come up to a happy medium, I guess. So we have to make sure that they understand that this is extremely important, that we crush Al-Qaeda everywhere we go, and we're willing to put aside other issues to achieve this primary goal.
What kinds of talent and resources are necessary to find the next wave that may pose a threat to this country, whether it's one of these Al-Qaeda splinter groups or something entirely new?
You have to have, at the end of the day, you have to have smart people working on this issue, and you have to empower these individuals to push the envelope. Prior to 9/11, it's actually quite difficult. If you were to say that an organization is going to hijack four different planes and crash them into several places all over D.C. and New York, that's a pretty far-fetched idea if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but somebody did, and somebody thought about it, and as long as we have good people working in government and people who are willing to think outside the box, you can actually perhaps stop the next one. You also have to create a well-educated populace. I'm not saying individuals should be paranoid about their neighbors, but people should just sort of keep their eyes open and be aware that bad things might happen. A great example of this is there was a T-shirt vendor in Times Square who noticed that there was a SUV parked illegally and it was smoking, and so he immediately told a cop. Cop checked it out, and they actually found out that there was a bomb in there, and they stopped a major attack on Times Square in 2010. And so you have to have a vigilant populace.
Aki Peretz is Senior National Security Advisor to the think tank Third Way. His new book, co-authored by Eric Rosenbach, is called Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Aki, great discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, which you can download for free at kera.org/think. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions about the show, you can send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.